Skywalker, come to me.
Hi, everybody. Decent thing for me to do after all the nice things for yourselves to die, probably. Well, I didn't prepare anything exactly. I got some old notes here. I figured, well, what the hell are you preparing? If I get killed on the way up here, look at the time I wasted. But I don't think that those of us in AA ever have to prepare anything. We've been there. We've been on both sides of the road. And at times like this, that I have wished God had put a window in my heart, so that you see how grateful and happy I am to be here at your 4th anniversary. To me, it's a great tribute to any one person that is asked to talk at an anniversary meeting. I think there is something special in each of our lives, because I'm sure to those of you that have come through this group from the start, and have had the tough times and the good times along the way, have known what a tough struggle it is. And at times you felt like giving up, no doubt about it. But if I can remember back a little bit that I was just glancing at in chapter 2 of the big book, there is a solution for you and I. Any time that we ever think that there isn't, we better go back and pick up the big book, because we will find the answer there if we look for it. It's entirely up to you and me to get out of this thing just what we want. If you're new here, believe me, we'd like to welcome you to the finest way of life on this earth, because you can accept or reject. It's entirely up to you. If you like what we got, and you want it, it's for you, for free. There's no time. There's no price tag on this thing. It can't be bought. And most of the people that's in it can't be bought. Now, when we were drinking and sitting on the bar stool alongside of some of you same people, we could be bought then. We'd sell our souls for a drink of whiskey. Oh, many times. We've all done it. Maybe you haven't, in your way of thinking. But I think if we take a soul-searching inventory, we will find that we have. Because I think that there's some place in the Bible that says man will destroy himself. What is the alcoholic doing when he's drinking? But destroying himself. The full torture. I know of these rarely torture chambers and everything that they have. Well, if there's any more torture than the torture that the alcoholic goes through. I don't think there's anything worse than the hangover, the sickness that the alcoholic has. And believe me, it is a sickness. It's a very, very many emotions to it. The alcoholic's emotions are like a mixed up ball of steel wool. When we're sober and throw a little whiskey into us, then brother, we really get off. We really get mixed up. We'll get mad, we'll get crying, we'll be trying to make love at the same time. You talk about mixed up emotions. Brother, we got them, believe me on that. But what does AA do? AA helps us to channel our emotions, so that we can gradually accept this way of life. I'm not going too deeply into my life because I don't think that's important. When I go to prison and I talk to my buddies, that's a little bit different. But I think that the important thing here is to give you a very quick summary of my life. I drank ever since I was able to carry a beer pail. I was probably drunk the first time at the age of 14, 15, 16, along in there. And being small for my age, I found a way out. And believe me, it was a way out, I thought. But I progressed. with alcohol. I became, rather became a mixed-in. I became a professional fighter. I boxed for a lot of years, and along with the boxing, I became a professional booze fighter, too. And I found out that was one thing that I couldn't make was old man body climbing. Because drinking cost me better than 10 years of my life in prisons and jails. Oh, and I spent a few years in Skid Row. And for things that I done while under the influence of alcohol, because I was sick, I was put in prison. I'm not rationalizing nothing, and I'm not making excuses. Because right today, I think that if a guy come along, I had a chance to kidnap him for $152,000, and I thought I could get away with it, I think I might try it. And I tried it. But I didn't get away with it. I eventually give myself up, and I wound up doing 5, 10 years in Jackson, and I'd done most of the 5. Because while I was there, I learned that the easiest way to do that time was to stay drunk, because I didn't know if I was in jail or where the hell I was. And I got out, and pretty soon I was in jails again, and pretty soon I was back in Jackson again. It isn't important, I don't think, the amount of time that we spent any place. The important fact is that I share with you a little bit of what happened to me, so that I may light a candle, so that you too won't fall in some of the pitfalls that I fell in. And right about here, I'd like to thank and be grateful to all the people that have had trouble with this program and is back there today. They had the courage to walk up them steps into this room. And believe me, from the things that I understand of some of these people, it takes courage. Because it's you that have lit that candle and showed me the pitfalls. It was you that told me that AA, once you become associated with it, it spoils your thinking. And I know that. Because I've listened to you fellows and gals tell me of the troubles. I've watched you. And I don't want to go through the same thing if I don't have to. And I don't have to unless I want to. Because in chapter 2, it tells us many things about the way out for us. We cannot help ourselves. After you came to this program, and had a period of sobriety, and all of a sudden this obsession of mine starts going. A nice warm day today, you go down the street and you see these signs flashing on and off, beer, wine, whiskey, so on and so forth. Jesus, I never had a drink for about 2 months. Now I think a couple of good cold ones wouldn't hurt me a bit. I'm sure that I could handle them.
Hey, you deserve it. You earned it.
You've been sober 3 months. After the alcoholic takes the first one, he or she don't drink then because they want to. They drink then because they have to. The obsession of the mind has held them into taking the drink. And once they take the drink, the mind says to the body, okay, you take over. I got them started. And again, for compulsive drinkers. I know about the compulsion to drink. I was that type of drinker. Maybe I wouldn't drink for 6 months. There has been times. Been rare. And all of a sudden, 3 o'clock in the morning, I'd get up. And in the dark, I'd be trying to get my clothes on. And my wife would put the light on. I didn't know if she heard me. She said, what the hell are you getting dressed for? And I'd say, I got a deal. I got to go meet a guy. I got a big deal on. You know what the big deal was? I had to go get a bottle. Oh, I know about that compulsion. I even had it after I come to AA. So along with all these trials and tribulations that we have with life and this alcoholic problem, we can do 2 things. We can trudge the road with our problem. Me and my problem, and the bottle, down through the pitfalls, the horror and hell, or we can trudge the happy road with AA and God, It's entirely up to us. I like this way of living. You give it to me. And you didn't ask me how much money I had to join this organization. And when you people called on me, you didn't ask me what side of the tracks I come from. You didn't ask me the color of my skin. You didn't ask me my religion. And the greatest thing of all was, you didn't say that you had to be from a certain standard or class in order to belong. You said if you're an alcoholic, you're at home. Welcome. You're one of us. And AA has taught me so many things that I'll be eternally grateful for. AA has taught me that there's only one race. That's the human race. And in AA, we do things together. And it has also taught me that there's only one religion here. That's the spiritual way of living. When each of us leave here, we can go to the choice of a church of our choice. It's entirely up to us. There's so many things that can be said about AA and the people in it. But the only one that I can say anything about is me. I can't say anything about you. I can tell you what happened to me and how grateful I am that some of the things that happened did happen. Because I'm not so sure otherwise. I think that all of us have to go just as far as we go before we're ever going to do anything. I think that we have to just get sick of ourselves before we're finally going to start to want to do something about ourselves. I like to say that if you can just take one thing from this meeting, remember when, when you made a phone call, when you were pushed, you were dragged, you were threatened, I don't care how you came, but remember when you came. Just remember that, if you will. I don't think that any of us will want to go back to where we was when we called AA, or our wife called, or the priest called, or the hospital called. We're damn near ready for the mortgage call. And I don't think any of us want to go back there. And all I got to do is remember when I used to crawl up out that hole down there by the CKNS track, crawl up out them weeds, and maybe look around down there to see if any of us lost any pennies. And I could get out in the street and try and get the fight. And sometimes I was shaking so bad I couldn't even ask for the price. But I could walk into one of these dingy bars and ask for a double shot of wine and throw it down and walk out. Or I couldn't go back there again. But I got many eye-opener that way. And I remember that. And I also remember the while a lot of these people in this program told me that the only difference between the drunk in the penthouse and the silken gown and the one down the railroad tracks is altitude. Give them both a fifth of whiskey and they'll reach the same level in one hell of a hurry. Believe me on that. So here we are, and we're together. Why? Because we want to do something about our problem. So if you can just take and remember when you came to AA, and then ask yourself, what was I looking for? And then I think that you're starting on the right track. Because I think that as we're handed these tools in AA, and I think to most of us, it looks like a jigsaw. I know they handed me a lot of these little booklets, and they handed me the big book, and they said, here, read it. And I couldn't see it, let alone read it. My wife called AA, well, it'd be my ex-wife at that time. And if you don't think that alcohol is a remover, brother, start looking around. Because I can remember that at one time I had an automobile. It wasn't too good, but it was an automobile. I had a boat, I had a motor, I had a lot of fishing equipment, I had a double-barrel shotgun. Oh, it wasn't all paper, but I had it. And we had furniture in the house and everything else. And then I can remember at the age of 33, when I got too old to work, so I run away from home. And I used to come back to the house and I'd steal the stuff out of the house. I remember one time that after the car was gone, that the trailer and boat was sitting in the backyard, and I'm pushing this trailer and boat down the street, and I got $20 for it. Now, I can remember that, and I can remember when I walked down the street with a Davenport on my back. You ever see a guy go down Woodard Avenue with a Davenport on his back? I went down Woodard Avenue or any place else. I had a friend in the gym, you know, who didn't have no Davenport. He needed that Davenport. I didn't have no whiskey. So I got a gallon of whiskey for it. When my wife came home and she seen this wicker furniture in the, from the porch, she says, "What's it coming to Davenport in a big chair? Honey, you deserve it. Something better. I'm getting the Davenport recovered for you. You're worth it." She was. She was making $12 a week. And I was stealing a little bit off my money. She said, "Well, gee, that's nice of you to send that out and get it fixed and colored for me." I said, "Glad to do it, honey. You're earning it. You're the breadwinner now." So the week went by, and I went away, and I come back, and I was down making a tour, looking at my property down the tractor. She says to me, "What about this? Where did you send this Davenport and this chair to be fixed and covered?" I said, "Oh," I said, "that." I said, "Well," I said, "I'll tell you, I think there might be a little delay in you getting it back." I said, "Fact of the matter is, I don't think you can get it back." She says, "Why not?" She says, "Are the people going out of business or something?" I said, "No, no, they're still in business." I said, "But the place that I took it, they don't repair stuff like that." I said, "They give you this stuff as a remover," I said. "Whiskey. You see, the whiskey was removing the furniture out of my house. It already removed that car and that boat and motor, and it was gradually removing the furniture. We didn't have no more rugs on the floor. Didn't have a little fill rug to put in front of the, we didn't have a bathtub. We didn't have that big house. We only had a little stool in there. Didn't have a throw rug for putting in front of the bed even. Or the brewer had throw rugs." And this, I come in there one day and I through the front door because I got damn tired of coming through the back door. And every time I come through there, and she'd meet me, and she'd say, "All right, take them off." She'd undress to take my clothes off me. "And you've seen him scrub an elephant, haven't you?" Well, that's the way my wife used to scrub me with that brush and cold water. I couldn't understand why, but I could now. She didn't want to get lousy, and believe me, I was lousy like I've been back. So I said, so I come through the front door, and this day when I come through there on the buffet, it was something like this today, hot, and this big band was going to back and forth. I looked around, I didn't see that thing. "Where the hell did that fan come from? I don't ever remember a hockey fan." So I grabbed the fan on one hand and the cord in the other, and I had that baby hockey before the blade stopped turning. Believe me. I come home and she says, as about a week later, "What become of that fan that was on the buffet?" She says, "The neighbors loaned it to us." I said, "Get out of here." She says, "Yeah, it was awful hot in this apartment." And I said, "Well," I says, "I know what it is." I said, "I got $2 for it. Now, if you want to give me the $2, I'll go get it." But you know she didn't. Then I told her about the time that she was hollering about it being hot, and I come home one time and it was cold in there. And I told her about trying to freeze me out because I didn't come home very often. And she told me then that the coal man had cut us off. We couldn't get no more coal. And of course, you know, I'm the alcoholic. And we got to be big shots right away. And I said, "I'll be damned if I can do that to you. I'll see if you can get some coal." And so I left. And when I come back, I finally come back, she had a quarter of a ton of coal in the basement. I said, "See that? You don't have to worry about it. The old man takes care of everything. He leaves, he should tell you. You never had it so good." I went down to Salvation Army and begged him for some coal. Well, I had to put on the act. She never had it so good. I was looking out for her. Oh, yes, I stole everything out of the house. Everybody lived better than I did. And yet, when they handed me the tools of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I looked at them, and they read them to me at first, when these two men come to see me, I was in a tavern, because they'd already said they'd be there the night before, and they didn't come. And so I went upstairs, and I come back down the next morning, and I called them, and when I called AA, myself, a lovely lady answered the phone, and she says, "This is Alcoholics Anonymous. Could we help you?" Well, boy, about that time, she knocked me around the seat of my pants. Because ordinarily, if anyone said, "Could they help me?" I'd say, "Yeah, buy me a couple of drinks." So that was the first time in many years that anyone said, "Could they help me?" And I listened to them. And she started asking me what my trouble was. And I said, "Well, Brother, I haven't got no trouble," I said, "but my wife called last night," I said, "and you people said there'd be someone down here at 7 o'clock. And nobody showed up." She says, "Well, is your wife an alcoholic?" I told her, "I don't know." And she says, "Well, how much does your wife drink?" And I said, "Oh, probably about 2 beers a year." She says, "Well, alcohol is no problem with it, isn't it?" I said, "Well, I don't know." She says, "Well, who wants to quit drinking?" I said, "Well, I guess she wants me to quit drinking." I mentioned that I would. And she says, "Well, do you want to quit drinking?" And I said, "Well, I don't know." She said, "Well, are you an alcoholic?" I said, "I don't know. I didn't know what the hell an alcoholic was. I didn't know if it was some kind of a disease or a contagious or what the hell. I didn't know." She says, "Well, do you drink a whole lot?" And I said, I don't think too much. She says, "Well, does drinking cause you any trouble? Do you get in any trouble?" I said, "Nothing too serious. Could happen. Armed robbery, cut a man, kill a man with an automobile. Nothing serious." She says, "Do you want to quit drinking then?" And I said, I guess so. She said, "There'll be a couple of men down to see you tonight then." Now, I thought that this AA was for businessmen. And that if you went with these good people, and they taught you how to drink, and they got in a room behind closed doors, and they drank, and if you got in trouble, they helped you out. Well, I was going to keep them guys busy. So they said they'd be down at 7 o'clock that night. And I says, "By the way, what the hell's the matter with right now? You know, drank 25, 30 years, all of a sudden I'm to drink, I want it now, like all the other alcoholics." She says, "Oh, they're all working now." They can't stay away to come and see me. She says, "Well, there'll be somebody down." I says, "Okay." She says, "Are you drinking now?" And I said, "Not too much." She said, "Well, don't drink anymore." I said, "No, I won't drink anymore." After I hung the phone up, I said, "Hell no, I'll drink just as much though." Well, come 7 o'clock and I was over to the tavern. And I had 12 to go and I had some whiskey home. So I come back after my kid came over to get me, and I put my hand in his and he led me home. And I walked in and I set these 12 beers down at the dining room table and I opened the icebox door and I said to Larry and Jimmy, I said, "Be right with you, fellas, just as soon as I take care of my beer." And so I piled 9 in the icebox and I left 3 sitting on the table. I said, "You fellas stare for a bottle of beer in there?" "No, we're not drinking today." "To hell with them, that much more for me." So I stuck 2 glasses in the icebox. And I said, "You don't care if I have one, do you?" Larry, he's a very sharp old cookie. He said, "No, go ahead. If you accept this program, it'll be your last." Last? I brushed that baby off right quick. So I went in there and I sit there and I told him about all the automobile wrecks I'd been in and the running gun fights I'd been in. And, well, I'd never shot it in my life. I've shot a lot of times. But I figured they was lying to me, some of the things they told me. And, you know, in the alcoholics, the first liar don't never have a chance. So when they got all through, they left. I don't remember too much what they said that night. But that's why I always will never fail to make the call, the first call, on the alcoholic. For the simple reason that he or she may never remember one thing that you said, but they'll remember you were there. You were there. And finally they found somebody that cared. Finally they found somebody that wanted them and accepted them. And that was the way in my case. Because when I come downstairs the next day to go to the icebox, and I open the icebox morning, this icebox door on this morning, I could visualize Larry and Jimmy sitting in the front room. And I think on the morning of October 31st, 1945, I had my spiritual awakening, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because right then and there, the thought comes to me what Larry said when he left the house. That if I was sincere for the first time in my life, he didn't say anything about being honest, he knew damn right well I was honest. I would pray instead of going to the icebox the next morning. I shut the icebox, and I went in the bedroom, and I prayed. I think my prayer went something like this. I'm not sure, and I don't know if I kneeled, stood, lay down, crawled, walked, or how, but I think that I kneeled with hope, and I think that I stood up with faith, and I think that I've lived with knowledge that I'm getting spiritual help one day at a time. Like they told me in this program, to do it the easy way, our way, which is God's way. I've learned that there's three ways of doing everything. Your way, my way, and the right way. And the right way is usually God's way. When you pray, you usually get three answers back. Yes, no, and wait. And wait for the alcoholic. Brother, we don't want to wait for nothing. But we find through this program that we get what we need, not necessarily what we want. We get what is God has good for us. God permits us to do many things, but he doesn't always approve of us. So I think on that morning of October the 31st, that the prayer that I said, no matter how simple it was, was sincere. I think that I realized right then and there that I was a child of God. I don't know. Because if we'll remember, when we have those of us that have raised children, then when we're trying to teach our kids something, if he wants something, we teach him to say please. After we give it to him, we teach him to say thank you. And I think that's just the way with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That if you want something, you say please to God. And you pray in the morning for it. And you do nothing but say three words. God help me. And after you have this day of sobriety, a minute at a time, you say thank you. I used to, when I first came to this program, look at that first step. And I had a son of a gun in time with it. I would admit that I was powerless over alcohol, and then I'd screw my hazy eyes, and believe me, your eyes are hazy, and you know it. I would look at it and see there where it said that my wife had become unmanageable. Who knew she was unmanageable? Because she divorced me when I was in Jackson prison. Look at all the things that she'd done. But after the fog got started to lift a little bit, and I think the best way that you can explain it is that there's many ways, and I think that a real nice way, that one thing that a friend of mine mentioned one time about looking at the light, but he mentioned about how blurry the eyes. Well, I use it in the same way with the alcoholic's mind. That if we look at a light, that light right there, for a few minutes, and then look out at the people, they're very hazy. Well, that's the way the alcoholic's mind is when he first comes to his program. And it takes a long time. We have to look around and see a lot of things before our mind starts to open a little bit and we realize that our life is unmanageable. And I was doing that. And then I got to thinking about Jackson Prison. I got to thinking about all the years that these jails through the country in these county jails and these city jails and the police department and these policemen and everybody else managed my life. And I remember then when I went in Jackson prison, they told me how much time to do. And I remember that they even put me in a cell. Then I remember that they blow the bugle real loud in the morning, and they told me to get out behind the guy next to me. And I think that they told me to follow the guy ahead of me, and then I wouldn't get lost on the way to the dining room. So I done that. And then they had a man behind me, so in case I started to drag a little bit, he would step on my heels, and I would keep catching up. And then when I walked in the dining room, they gave me a pile of trays there. I picked that tray up. And I walked over and they put the food on it. Because they knew that I didn't know nothing about the rules there. And so they put the food on it. To make sure that I wouldn't starve for that, because I would get too much. And then on the way out, they told me about I could pile my dishes up. I didn't even have to wash them. And then I marched back to that cell. And then they told me when I could go to work. Once a week, they turned the laundry right in there on the bed. I didn't even have to go after it. They delivered it. At one sheet a week. At one pillowcase a week. And if I was lucky and had two pairs of state socks in the first winter, I'd get two clean pairs, or three clean pairs, however many I had. And you get that one towel. Then they told you when to take a bath. Then they told you when you could go get a haircut. And it wasn't soon that I learned for two facts you could get a pretty good haircut. You didn't get one in a state haircut. For the half shelf yet. I learned them things. And then I got to look at the ads, and I finally got these radios in there. They didn't have them at first. And you couldn't even make no mistakes there. You didn't have no dials to turn. You couldn't get mixed up on the station. They got red, white, and blue. Columbia Broadcasting Station, NBC, and Newsville. And so it was all fine. They made the decision. They selected the station for me. I just pushed the plug in. And if I didn't like one, I pushed it in another one. And then at night, they'd even turn the lights off for me. I even had to turn the lights off. And then they shut the radio off for me at night. Either. And then they had a man walk him down in front of that cell and see if nobody kidnapped me. Then I began to realize how the hell unmanageable my life was. They really managed it. I had no decisions to make. And I was up my second march and I seen the new cell block that they got up there. You got to do tailor-made now up there for them guys. Them guys, well, when I get ready to retire, I'm going up to Marquette. You don't even have no problems with water up there. There's no valves on in the shower. You can't get too much cold water, too much hot water. You don't have to worry about that. You just push a button, and the water comes out for a couple of minutes, and you get all soaking wet. Then you soak up. Then when you want to rinse off, you press the button again. And the water comes out all mixed. You don't have to worry about no decision. Then I wonder why a guy can't manage his life when he gets out of one of them joints. They even tell you how the hell I mix the water. So I looked at that and I remembered how unmanageable my life suddenly must have been. And I realized then that it was all through alcohol. And I was told by my sponsors and other people in this program that if I wanted to follow the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous and take these steps as they are, that I wouldn't have no trouble. And I went to my first meeting. I'll never forget it because I like to impress upon you how important it is to attend meetings. The first meeting I went to was in a home. And in this house, I walked in the bay window, and that house was bigger than that door, and it was wider. And I looked at this fellow that was there. Henry Van Dyke, my guy that is dead now, and a wonderful AA. Lord have mercy on his soul. And I looked at him and I said to my sponsor, I said, what in the hell is he doing here? He said, Henry? I said, yeah. He said, Henry, he lives here. He owns this house. I said, lives here? Owns this house? I looked around, big stone fireplace in it, and tried to answer. Who in the hell did he rob to get money to buy this house? I believe that's the only way he could get it. Then I found out that he'd been sober 4.5 years. 4.5 years. Jesus, these guys who are sober for 2 weeks, a month, hell, that didn't impress me. Because I've been that sober that long myself. But here was Henry sober 4.5 years. I wanted to be like Henry. Because the last time I knew Henry, before I went to Jackson prison, he was getting evicted from a little four-room apartment with five kids in it. I went out there with him, and we were throwing his beer in the icebox, and his wife found him and I and the beer out. And so we went upstairs with a little blonde and drank. Yes, I remember that, and I wanted to be like Henry. And Henry told me then, he said, if you have trouble, he said, and things get going rough, he says, you call me. He said, but you call me before I die, not after. My sponsor used to tell me to call him. And I called my sponsor. And it got to the point that he finally one day, always at 6 o'clock, I got homework at 5 myself, and I always about 6 o'clock. Finally one day later, he said, I know damn right well, you are just getting ready to sit down and eat a steak. He told me if I had any problems, Larry, to call you. I said, I got problems. He said, hell, I've never seen a guy with so many problems. So I said, okay. So he happened to me at night, too. So I would get a compulsion to drink. 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, I would pick up the telephone and call Henry Van Dyke. And Henry said, you know what time it is? I said, surely, I'm sober, 4 o'clock in the morning. He said, Wyndham, how are you calling me at 4 o'clock in the morning for? I said, you remember what you told me, Henry? So any time I wanted to drink to call you, they would help you more than to get me. Well, I'm giving you a chance to help yourself right now. I said, I've got a compulsion to drink. I want to go drink. And he said, you want me to come over, Shot? And I said, no, Henry, just talk to me. And he would talk to me. And for 5 years in this program, I had a compulsion to drink. And I know what it is. I know what that driving compulsion is. I've seen others with it. Many of them. Some recognize it, some didn't. But the compulsion to drink is terrible. It's terrific. But there is an answer. And I think that one of them is that a man or woman can reach their greatest height while upon their knees. I think another one is to call another AA before you take a drink, not after. It's just like an alcoholic coming out of prison. The time to get a hold of a sponsor is before. Because before you even go see the pro man. Because he ain't no good that fool man or anybody else after he's got 8-10 slugs of whiskey in his belt. Believe me on that. So in AA we say, before, not after. It's a little bit late then. So I feel sure that people that attend meetings within themselves, whether they realize it or not, are doing a great feat of 12-step work. I, for one, will never forget my sponsors. I will never forget the man that listened to me on the other end of the telephone at 4 o'clock in the morning. Many times, though he's dead and been dead a year this month, I will never forget him. I know a lot of times a lot of us have a lot of still ways of showing our gratitude. But I think that the strongest tool in the epitome of Alcoholics Anonymous is gratitude to our fellow man. Just being grateful to walk down the street sober and to reach out a hand of friendship. You say, welcome, brother. You're one of us. If I can help you in any way, don't hesitate to call me. But you know when you say it. Oh, I know that there's all we procrastinate a lot of times. I know that. I have been guilty of it. I know that I have taken the inventory of Shy Walker many, many times. And I know what's within me. And I know a lot of other people that have taken my inventory many, many times. Some of them are staying sober. I have a friend, close friend. He's been around this program better than 20 years. He's taken my inventory up and down. But times it takes over, times it gone. But I owe a deep debt of gratitude to that man, because that man has showed me and told me many times what not to do. Here is an example. If he can never be used for nothing else, he can always be used for the horrible example. I think that all of us, within ourselves, have something special within us. And I think that for so many years, we've been so busy trying to be somebody else that we never took time to be ourselves. And now that we have, and we look in the mirror, we realize that we got better within us than the people that we tried to be. And they told me that. You people told me to just be myself. And that's all I try to be. I'm nothing fancy. I don't want to be anything fancy. I don't know nothing about any big words. All I tried to use them, I had a head sister that lived with me for 3.5 years. Harry remembers them. And he was trying to get me to say all these words. He even was teaching me to say anonymous. I don't know if I say it right yet or not. And he was saying, I'll say Annie Mouth. And he was trying to teach me these different words. And so a couple of times I left him another friend of mine who was an alcoholic, Dr. Burrell. Hey, what the hell are you trying to say? And I finally used some of these big words that his head friend was teaching me. And I said, well, I said, Doc Paul told me to use them words. He said, the hell with Doc Paul. He said, you'd be Cy Walker. He said, nobody's going to know you if you start using them words. He said, you don't even know what you're talking about. I thought I was telling the truth. I said, but I thought I was told with it. Because he told me where to use them, but I was putting them in the wrong place. And now it was, I was putting them after when I should have been putting them before. You know, getting a horse in the river at night. So, in all ways, they teach us to just be ourselves. And to realize that if God wanted something else or somebody else, he would have made it somebody else. So, when you and I start looking at the jigsaw of the 12 steps, and believe me, it is a jigsaw. Because it's a mixed up net to us. The first comes to the end. I said, like the big book says in chapter 5, my God, what an order. How can I do it? Oh, I jumped around. I was a first and 12th temple for a long time. Oh, I didn't know nothing about turning my will and life over to God. I turned my drinking problem over to God, but nothing else. Because I was still picking up little change off my card table, things like that, dealing with folks and anything, because I just figured that the line of honesty didn't have to be too thin. And I robbed a guy at a train one time, and I hit him in the back, or in the back in the little restroom, you know, and I got this guy's pocketbook. And I'm thinking, boy, I'm going to listen to these people in here a little bit more. They don't even know what they're talking about. They told me not to worry about nothing, that God would take care of everything. He sent me this guy, all I had to do was do the legwork, get the money out of his pocket. They teach us to just be ourselves. And to realize that if God wanted something else or somebody else, he would have made it somebody else. So when you and I start looking at the jigsaw of the 12 steps, and believe me, it is a jigsaw. Because it's a mixed up net to us. The first comes to AA. I say, like the big book says in chapter 5, my God, what an order. How can I do it? Oh, I jumped around. I was a first and 12th stepper for a long time. Oh, I didn't know nothing about turning my will and life over to God. I turned my drinking problem over to God, nothing else. Because I was still picking up little things off my card table, things like that, dealing with folks and things, because I just figured that the line of honesty didn't have to be too thin. And I robbed a guy at a train one time, and I was sitting in a guy in the back in the little restroom, you know, and I got this guy's pocketbook. And I'm thinking, boy, I'm going to listen to these people more a little bit more. They don't even know what they were talking about. They told me not to worry about nothing, that God would take care of everything. He sent me this guy, that all I had to do was do the legwork, get the money out of his pocket. I done the legwork, I got the pocketbook here, there's hundreds of dollars here. To prove it. And these people know what they're talking about.
But the laborers are in the wrong direction. So if the thought comes to me that the Henry Van Dyken always used to say, you gotta be honest and take an inventory. So I did take an inventory of that very pop of it right then and there. I found it. And I found it was $2,000 worth of salvage checks in there. And I got to thinking, now gee, if I endorse some salvage checks and get them cash, and then I get caught, why the hell is the honest? So I didn't take the salvage check. Then I looked at these $100 bills in there. And I got caught then about that to be honest and take an inventory. They didn't mean that I had the inventory at possible, and now I had the inventory on me. So I just reached in and took some money and stuck it in my pocket, sit down alongside this guy and dropped this pocketbook in his coat pocket. Now that was my line of honesty, $68 is all I took. So I thought I was being honest, because I didn't take all his money. That was better than I used to be. But after 20 months in this program, I went to Father Powell in the engineer, and I spent 4 hours with him. And I found out that the line of honesty was a little bit different. And the inventory you took wasn't the guy's pocketbook. And little things like that after sitting there. Oh, I know that these people in there told me, but I didn't tell them too much about me, because I didn't trust these people in there. I figured that if I told them a lot of things, that they'd go tell the police department and I'd be back in Jackson prison. So I didn't go tell them. I was still on parole. So I took over to Father Fowl and I said to him. And he didn't tell me that I had to go to the police department or do anything else. He told me to start getting honest, which I wasn't. And that meant all the way. Not when I was in a card game to pick up 90 cents off the guy next to me. Or the guy on my left takes the change of a $10 bill or something like that. Or to be gaming poker and wants to take a quarter, I'll take a dollar a quarter. He didn't tell me that. He just says, don't do it, period. And I found out that he told me the truth. Because I hadn't had no trouble. Oh, I had trouble with my picking. Because I think all of us have trouble with our picking. I don't have a drinking problem today. I turn it over to God. But I still have a thinking and a living problem. Something I think that all of us have in every walk of life. And the proof of that is that the story of the farmer that had this boy, and he figured that he was going to take this boy to the head shrinker because he just didn't seem to act right. And so he went into this doctor's office, and the doctor put the boy up on the couch, and he says, I'll answer this question, you answer them, the first thing that comes to your mind. So he says, now he says, son, he says, he was in bed in his farmhouse, he says, and all of a sudden he says, you heard this cow out in the barn, flapping and paws up a big butt. You jumped out of bed and walked out there in your bare feet, and you stepped in something soft and mushy. What would that be? He said, why, a newborn calf. That's right, son, that's right. He's another son, he says. What is it that this cow has four of that your mother only has two of? Why, look. He says, that's right, son, that's right. And son, he says, what is it that you get here from your parents that your mother doesn't have hay? He says, why, cock. He said, that's right, son, that's right. About that time, the old man started over towards that kid. He says, don't you hit that kid. He says, what in hell? He says, I'm going to get up my couch early, Mr. First Three. How was your thinking? How many did you miss? I think that goes with all of us. That it boils down to how we're thinking now. And I don't think that there's anything that will ever take the pleasure of time in this program. Because the more that we're around, the more that we learn, and we realize how little we really need at the start. Because as time marches on, our minds become more and more open. And there's nothing that any of us can ever say that hasn't been said before. Because they tell us
it's all repetition. It's all over and over again. The book was written in 1939, and it's people in AA that helped write the book. And it's so easy. Because every time you pick up the big book, you find something that you missed before. I know that a lot of things that will become ungrateful, that word that I spoke about. And the proof of it is, I'm going to ask a few questions. You answer them to yourself. I would like to ask you, how long since you set up with a nice, right drum? A real nice, stinky one. A real nice one that will feed them all over every once in a while. A real nice one that will cut you off and try to push you around. Guess how long have you and I set up for the night? I would like to ask how long since you read a big book? I hate like hell to ask this question. How many of you read all the big book? I'm not reading books. I think I do. I'm not a book reader. But I want to stay sober. And they told me that if I wanted to stay sober, to use the tools of the AA, and you will stay sober. And this big book of alcohol, and this is one of the tools. It's one of the first principles of AA. And you'll find a lot of little principles right along with it on the inside. By leaving you there. You do what you want in this program. Anytime that a person tells me that they left an AA meeting and they didn't take nothing with them from the meeting, I ask them one thing. Did you bring anything to play with? Just as simple as that. Did you come with an open mind? Because I know that anytime I go into a store, with all these shelves that are loaded, I've got to get me a banker. And I certainly don't need everything that's on them shelves. I might buy a lot of them, so I take the basket and I put in that basket just what I need. And when I leave, I've taken something from the store. So when I come to the store of AA, I bring a basket. Right there, an open mind. And I also keep an open mind. I try to lead my fellow men in. Men on their own. Let them help themselves to send you through the news that you and I have been so fortunate to be given. Because it's all by the grace of God. It's all by the grace of God that you and I are here today. Because I think that there's about 100 of those going down the road to alcoholism that are falling one way only, into oblivion and death. And by the grace of God, I am one of them, like me, that have found a way to stay sober one day at a time. None can stay sober forever. None of them can grab a hold and hang on to all that there is in this place. He keeps me there a little bit at a time. Because as time lapses on, we realize things that we hold back 10 years ago, and now they're just starting to sink in. Because don't forget, at that time, 10 years ago, we wasn't ready to accept what was given to us. Our mind wasn't conditioned, because this program is a program of conditioning. Just like you and I, that the house that we live in is this house right here. Us. You and I. And then in chapter 11, it tells us that we get our own house in order in a vision for you in this great book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it also tells you in there that we all meet on the happy road to destiny. So how can I meet anybody if I don't condition myself so that I can accept the gift of God that's handed to me
set free. By you, my brother and sister, you give it to me. And you give it to me with a free will. There's no strings attached. You don't again, like I said, put a price tag on it. You don't do it for any glory. You do it for a very selfish reason. Somebody done the same thing to you. And you found that person that gave it to you the same sober. So you want to stay sober. My sponsor asked me after a few months of this program if I wanted to stay sober. He said, now that you've got sober, do you want to stay sober? And I think that's been damn important. First, we've got to get sober. And then we have to stop and think, do we want to stay sober? And then we have to stop and realize that it's easier to stay sober than it is to get sober. Because we go through hell, always. And he told me if I wanted to stay sober, to do what I was asked in AA within reason, attend meetings, and do 12-step work. And I never had any trouble. And I found out through the years that he told me the truth. I also found out down through the years that not only did I get sobriety and a little bit of peace of mind, but you give me trust. After I was in AA 2 years, about a year, we got a hall. And I was pressed to be janitor in that hall. I was pressed with a key. I was pressed to make the coffee. They knew I wouldn't take it down and cut down to the boys on the track. They knew that I wouldn't sell the furniture up there, at least they had paid for that one. And faith is sanity. And fear is insanity. You and I know that. He had it for a long time. And they had faith. And by golly, I didn't either. And then pretty soon, I think I was around there about 3 years. And they trusted me to be chairman at a closed meeting one day. I think I was around there about 6 years. And I finally trusted to be chairman at an open meeting. See, I was like that mule, you know. I had to get hit in the head all the time. I was around there about 8 years, and I finally trusted with the money. I trusted the secretary and treasurer. And you know, none of that money stuck there, and just wagging your little fingers, they got it all back. And then in the year, then I was finally trusted to be general service representative. And then they thought enough of me and trusted me enough to be committed. And then in the year of 1958 and 59, I was trusted to be the servant. In New York office, I was delegated to Southwestern Michigan. Oh, I wasn't like elected by a landslide vote. My name came out of the hat. And I always say, it was an act of God. But at least I was trusted to be a faithful and trusted servant of AA. I was trusted to do the bidding of the people in Southwestern Michigan. And I found that the trust that you people give me is the greatest trust that can be bestowed upon a human being. I was trusted with your little worries, your little cares, yes, and the big happy life. But the other trust that I was given was another great trust. I was trusted to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. To the sickly drunk, that's still out there on the street. How wonderful it was to be trusted by God today when yesterday I wasn't trusted by man. Trust is a great thing, my friend. I will forever and eternally be grateful to the people in AA that have been so good to me and have been so kind to me and have been so understanding. And have been so trusted, that's where we are. So that I can try and put back a little bit of what I got from this program. And the many things that if I was allowed to stand up here for 2 weeks, I could never tell you of all the things that have been given to me by you people. I know you know without a bit of doubt,
that there isn't any man or woman that comes into this program that ever has to apologize for being me. They're just as good as anybody that's been around for 25 years. Because this is one program that you can become new in one hell of a hurry. One drink and you're brand new again. Never do I feel that I am any better than anybody else. But by the same token, I don't feel that they're any better than me. And I thank AA and the people that put the tradition in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, because tradition one says that our common welfare comes first, that our recovery depends upon our AA unity. We don't come here to fight with nobody. If I want to fight with people, I'll go back to the bar. I can get in fights there without even half trying. Here, we depend upon unity, and in unity we get the strength. And I didn't come to AA to have somebody manage my life, to tell me how to manage my life, or tell me what I'm doing and what I'm not doing. I came to AA to get sober. I came to AA because I had an alcoholic problem. But I found many other things besides sobriety in this program. And I found that I could turn my will and my life over to God, as I understand. I won't turn it over to you. Because if you're so good at managing somebody else's life, what in the hell are you doing here? You can't even manage your own. So I learned that in AA, we don't come to manage somebody else's life. Or we don't come to have somebody else manage our own life. We come to AA to help us to straighten out with our different problems. And then we find the many other gifts that are given to us. The spiritual way of living, which is a wonderful way. And you and I have learned all these things. And we've got it all for free. But yet when the basket is passed, we're like the guy that says to his sponsor, "Hell, I ain't going to that AA meeting anymore." He says, "You told me this thing was for free. Every time I go to that meeting, you shove my basket underneath my nose. Put in money." The hell of that AA business. I ain't going no more. This old wise sponsor says you can learn nothing. If I felt like you, I probably wouldn't go either. He said, "Let me tell you a story." He says, "My wife and I," he said, "before we married, was working in a factory. We both making good money. And all of a sudden, I decided that if I marry that woman, and we're working, we can live on my wages and put hers in the bank in a joint bank account. That would be pretty sweet." So we got married. Well, we wasn't married too long before my wife quit nursing because she got pregnant. So we lost that money. And then it wasn't too long before that she had to go to the hospital, she had to have that baby. And then there was hospital bills. Then pretty soon it was sexy. And then pretty soon she started to draw all those other clothes and was going to school. Then pretty soon it got to the point that we had to go to college. And I had to get another job part time to help them go to college. Then pretty soon you had to have a jalopy to drive around with it. The boys had more money, they just keep costing me and costing me and costing me. He says, "You know," he says, "the second year of college," he says, "my son died. He don't cost me anything now." Yes? What do you know? Whatever we live, without it, he died. Do you want to live or do you want it to die? It's entirely up to you, and you alone can make the decision. This is your program. Nobody can take you out of it. Nobody can take it away from you. Because tradition tells you that. But the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop them. A guy can be laying on the floor, blind drunk, and he can say that I'm a member of AA. And who are you and I to say that he isn't? Because who are you and I to be start playing God and say whether he or she has a desire to stop drinking or not? How do you know whether they have a desire to stop drinking or not? And I think if there's ever anything that makes the angels in heaven weep, it's one alcoholic judging another. Oh, I don't want no halo, and I don't want to sprout no wings. He says if I sprout wings, I'm going to fly right into a bar. And then that damn halo will slip down and slip, and I won't be able to get the wings down. No, I just want to be me. I just want to remember that dying gal that's out there walking the street. There might be one of the 100 a day that goes down that road. I know that AA can't be bought by you and I by the coin of man, but it could be purchased for us through the currency of God and complete surrender. We put fighting and surrender to victory. The greatest victory that you and I can ever find. When we come to the little old door of my J.A., at first we batter, and we can knock it down. But then we speak, and we enter. Very simple. You must learn that. But a lot of us have to learn it the hard way. We fight them. But finally we surrender, and we find that we have just gained the victory. And we find that a great gift is to watch a so-called baby in AA. I think the reason they call them babies is because you know you should have a bottle of it with the baby and you take it away, they start crying. A lot of us start crying when they take the bottle away from it, you know. And I think that's probably one of the reasons. To watch this kid and the baby grow. To watch him get sober. And pretty soon he'll be coming along and he'll say, I want you to meet so-and-so. And then pretty soon there'll be someone saying, you see that guy over there? That's my sponsor. And you just sponsor the other guy. How great it is. He watched another fellow come up that road. And I think that you and I know that why should we spend our good money to get sick while we can stay well for free? This is simply that. And when they say they keep this program simple, I like it that way. It's not necessarily simple, but I told you what a jigsaw. These 12 suggestions, that's what to me. I put the first one down, and I could see that it fit it in the right place. But I tried to put 3, I tried to put 5, I tried to put 12, but it wouldn't fit. But finally, I put 2 right alongside of it. And finally I put 3, 4, and right on down the line, as they told me. And down through the years, I finally got these 12 pieces put in the jigsaw program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found that it has made a picture. And the picture I found that it made was a picture of Guy Walker. I could see myself as I have been in the past, I can see myself as I am today. I can see myself as I can be if I follow the principles of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous one day at a time. And you two have taught me that a good idea might make me money, but only a high ideal will keep me happy. You two have taught me that a good idea might make me big before man, but only a high idea will keep me humble before God. It's been a wonderful audience, and may God bless you.